Section 2 is a huge section on the Series 6. We have to cover federal securities acts and FINRA rules, and we also have to look at taxation when we talk about this in the book. For the audio CDs, we're just going to cover the regulatory side here, and then we'll look at taxation in another section. The first Federal Securities Act, which means an act of the U.S. Congress that you need to know, is called the Securities Act of 1933. Kind of interesting that after the great crash of 1929, the first move that the federal government made was to say, okay, we're going to have to take some authority over the securities markets because there's a national interest in doing so. And the first thing we're going to do is make issuers of securities register their paper, the Paper Act, before they get to offer and sell that paper, whether it's a stock or a bond or whatever, to investors. You see, the primary market is how companies like Google and Microsoft and Oracle, etc., can go from a small growing company to a huge juggernaut. And if we don't have people with confidence to supply them with capital through an IPO or even an offering of bonds, the whole financial system actually could collapse. And so the first thing you need to know is that the Securities Act of 1933 took care of the first issue, which means you have to register your securities before you offer them and sell them to the public, and you have to provide full and fair disclosure. See, the federal government doesn't say that that security is too risky for that investor. What they're saying is it's not fair unless the investor knows all the important facts. All the material facts have to be disclosed. And if you lie to your investors in the prospectus or you leave out important facts, you're committing fraud, and it's going to be called wire or mail fraud, and it's going to be a big problem. So in the old days, they just let the securities markets kind of regulate themselves, but then with the Securities Act of 1933, unless you have some special exemption, you're going to have to register your securities. It's going to cost you a lot of time and money, and you're going to have to tell a lot of investors a lot of scary things before you can take their money. That's all that the Act of 33 has to do with, registering securities, providing full and fair disclosure. Some securities don't have to be registered under the Act of 33. U.S. government securities, municipal bonds, bank stock, short-term debt like commercial paper, for example, they don't have to be registered, but they are securities, so they are covered by the anti-fraud provisions of the Securities Exchange Act of 1934, which sounds really fancy. All it means is that when you're selling me a State of California general obligation bond, no, the bond does not have to be registered, but if you tell me something about this bond that isn't true, you've committed securities fraud. So the Securities Exchange Act of 1934 has anti-fraud provisions which cover all securities, whether they had to be registered or not. It also defines a security, and a security is not something like a whole life insurance policy or a fixed annuity. Those are pure insurance products. Commodity futures contracts like December wheat, those are covered by commodities regulators. But just about anything else could fit the definition of a security. And therefore, in the offer or sale of this security, if somebody tells somebody something that's not true or leaves out an important fact, they're committing fraud and they could be sued, and in some cases they end up going to jail. So what is a security? Well, as the Act of 1934 says, the term security means any note, stock, treasury stock, security future, bond, debenture, certificate of interest, or participation in any profit-sharing arrangement, or any oil, gas, or other mineral royalty or lease. And believe it or not, I'm only about 1/8 of the way through that paragraph. So they list all of these examples of securities, which means that, you know, if you're offering or selling any of this stuff, this has already been established as being a security. And they even use general phrases, like, I think this is like line 12. It says, any instrument commonly known as a security. So there's already case law on this. The courts have already established that thing as a security. So unless you're talking about whole life insurance, fixed annuity, term life insurance products, or commodity futures contracts, it's probably a security. So it may or may not need to be registered under the Act of 33, but if it's a security, it's covered by the anti-fraud statute, which says that if you tell me something that's not true or leave out an important fact in the offer or sale of a security, you're going to have huge problems. We also talk about an investment contract, which is one of the many examples of a security. And this is very fundamental to securities law because a lot of times companies, entrepreneurs want to offer you something without calling it stock or without using any recognized name for a security. But what they're saying under the Howey decision which defines an investment contract, is it's not what you call the thing, it's how it functions. Anytime you're trying to take an investor's money in a common enterprise where they benefit solely through the efforts of others, it's going to meet the definition of an investment contract, which is a security. I mean, it sounds bizarre, but if a local farmer needs capital to build a new barn or whatever he needs to do, and he goes around town printing up pieces of paper and telling people that for $10,000 I'll give you 4% of profits, well, they're not going to work at the farm. They never have. They have no managerial or work responsibilities. They're going to benefit solely through the efforts of others. That is an investment contract that is going to have to be registered, or even if it doesn't have to be registered, it's a security. So if he gives people bogus financials or he leaves out important facts, usually risks to the investment, he's committed fraud. So it might not sound like a security, but how does it function? If you're asking people to put money into a common enterprise where they benefit solely through the efforts of others, it's probably an investment contract, probably has to be registered, and even if it doesn't, it's a security subject to the anti-fraud rules. So when was the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, established? Well, remember, this is the world of securities, so it's not as logical as you'd like, you know, and it's not the Securities Act of 1933. It's the Securities Exchange Act of 1934. The SEC, this is the first time the federal government took such an active role in regulating the securities industry. Now, we now have SROs, self-regulatory organizations, like FINRA, or the Chicago Board Options Exchange, or the MSRB for munis. I don't expect that to be on the Series 6 so much. But the SEC is above all of those. If you're a self-regulatory organization, if you're a national stock exchange or a national securities association, you have to register with the SEC. So FINRA has a lot of authority over their members like Morgan Stanley and Merrill Lynch, but they also report to the SEC. And when FINRA wanted to become FINRA through a merger of NASD and NYSE, they had to get that signed off on by the SEC. It's a lot of acronyms and initials here, obviously. So the Securities Exchange Act of 34 is what established the SEC as the ultimate securities regulator. They're a government body. They're not a self-regulatory organization. So all of those SROs and exchanges have, you know, they have a lot of authority over their members, but they have to also report up to the SEC, basically. In the book, we talk a little bit about fingerprinting. Well, if you're involved with the books and records of a broker-dealer and, you know, taking cash in or handling securities, it's not a good idea to let convicted felons, people who used to drive trucks for Tony Soprano, get into that business. So they do require these people to submit fingerprints. Now, not everybody at the firm has to be fingerprinted, but if you're engaged in selling securities or doing the books and records, money in, money out, securities being transferred around, you're going to have to be fingerprinted. If you're only dealing with registered open-end investment companies or variable contracts, usually those are going to be handled by the transfer agent, so that would be different. But in general, anybody dealing with sales or money or securities at the broker-dealer will have to submit fingerprints. And if they're a convicted felon, you know, they're not going to get in, not even in New Jersey. Under the Act of 34, they already said that trading on material inside information, this is privileged information that Bill Gates and Steve Ballmer might know about at Microsoft, but nobody else. Well, those guys can't go around using that information or passing it around to people. And the fact that you play golf with Bill Gates and find out some big secret about Microsoft, you know, you're now an insider. And if you pass that information around, or even worse, try to use it for your own little benefit, it's going to be a big problem. So the Act of 34 already said that, but then in 1988, they passed the Insider Trading and Securities Fraud Enforcement Act, which updated the Act of 34 and raised the penalties. So if you know something about a public company that the general public doesn't know yet, you can't pass the information around, and you'd better not use that information for your benefit. Now, your benefit could mean, well, I know some really positive news, so I'm going to go buy stock ahead of the announcement. Or you know some really negative news and you want to dump the stock ahead of the announcement. And you can't be doing that. There are people still sitting in jail. You know, they were the CEO of this company. They found out that the FDA was not going to even review their key drug. And so they wanted to dump their stock for themselves and their friends and family ahead of the announcement. You can't do that. You know, you're a fiduciary to all the shareholders. You have to put their needs first when you're a CEO or on the board of directors. If it's just like being the captain of the Titanic, you can't see an iceberg and then grab the only lifeboat and jump off. You know, you're the captain. You steered us into this mess. If you know your company stock's about to take a hit, then you got to go down with the ship. So if you try to dump the stock ahead of bad news, that's just as bad as trying to profit from good news. Now, once the news has been announced, it goes out through CNBC or Wall Street Journal. Obviously, you can pass it around and act on it then. But oftentimes, only a select handful of people even know about this material inside information. So if they pass it around or use it, they could get sued by the SEC. And some people have even found out that the federal government will turn it into a criminal case and they'll end up going to jail. So watch out for that. So you'll probably get a question on the six. You know, you are playing golf with the CEO of a company and he happens to mention to you, well, don't pass the information around. He's already violated the act by telling you, but don't pass the information around. And yes, you could make some of your rich clients very happy by being very hush-hush about this, but if you pass the information around or use it, you're also going to end up talking to the SEC, possibly for the last time. I don't expect the six to go real far into investment advisors, but it's on the FINRA outline, so we have to cover it in the book and on the audio lectures. But understand at least this much. A broker-dealer is a business model where compensation comes from selling people securities. You guys are going to get your Series 6, and then you're going to come to my office and try to interest me in a mutual fund. If I don't buy it from you, you don't make any money. You're here to sell me a product. It just has to be suitable. Is it the best product for me? That's not your problem. It's just something that you could justify to the regulators as fitting in with Mr. Walker's needs. I explained everything. I gave him a prospectus. It was suitable. I'm a salesman. We call me an agent, and I work for a broker-dealer. So that business model is about selling product. Then there's another business model called investment advisory business, where I don't get compensated for selling you products at all. I either tell you what to do and charge you for my wisdom, or I manage your portfolio. You give me discretion over your account. I then manage the money as I see it being in being consistent with your needs. So I am making decisions for you, but everything I decide to buy or sell for your account is consistent with what you've told me in terms of your goals and your risk tolerance. But I'm not getting paid to sell you securities. I'm getting paid to manage your portfolio, or like a financial planner, I charge maybe $200 an hour to look at your situation and make a detailed recommendation about your retirement needs, your 529 plan, your insurance needs, et cetera, et cetera. So an investment advisor gets compensated for providing investment advice. See, when you get your Series 6, you're not going to charge me money to tell me which mutual fund to buy. You're going to try to sell me a mutual fund. You work for the broker-dealer side of the business. If you were an advisor, you'd be charging me just to tell me what to do. So I could be managing your portfolio, doing financial planning, or even selling reports to investors. In any case, my compensation comes from advice, therefore I'm an investment advisor. I could be a sole proprietor, or I might start hiring individuals to represent my investment advisory business, and we call those people investment advisor representatives. If you've been talking to people about taking the Series 65, that would be so that you can become an investment advisor rep. And now, instead of selling products to investors, you just want to get their account. You bring in that account, you get a percentage of their assets. Obviously, the advisory firm gets most of that percentage, but they share it with you. In order for you to get paid that way, you'd have to take a separate test called the Series 65. You'd be an investment advisor rep. I don't think we have to go too much farther than that. Just know that the advisor is the business. The individuals who represent it are investment advisor reps. They have to take a different exam because this is a different business model where the compensation comes from either telling people how to invest or doing it for them. It has nothing to do with selling product. Excuse me. Still kind of a warm day here in Chicago. The Investment Company Act of 1940, we're going to cover mutual funds in great detail in other sections, but they're obviously regulated under the Investment Company Act of 1940. So the Act of 1940 defines an investment company as any issuer which is or holds itself out as being engaged primarily or proposes to engage primarily in the business of investing, reinvesting, or trading in securities. So that's the way Congress writes. The way you and I might speak is, so an investment company is like a company who mainly invests? Yeah, That's what they are. It even says that if more than 40% of the company's total assets are tied up in securities investments, it is an investment company. We usually just call them, you know, mutual funds, which is really an open-end investment company. There are closed-end funds that we'll look at later, but the Investment Company Act of 1940 is what defines these things, forces them to register, and they're in a continuous state of offering. So that's why you'll always have a prospectus when you sell a mutual fund. It's a brand new share of stock to this investor, so there has to be a prospectus. But they do a continuous IPO if it's an open-end fund. The closed-end funds are unique. They do an IPO, and then investors would have to trade their shares back and forth. But both of them are considered investment companies, and specifically they're management companies. Those are the two that you hear about the most in the real world. There are also unit investment trusts, UITs. Those are not actively managed portfolios. They are trusts that usually hold preferred stock or bonds, and then you and I can buy units in them. So if you buy an open-end bond fund, that's going to be actively managed. The portfolio manager is going to be buying and selling various bonds. A unit investment trust that holds bonds would just hold them until they mature. And then the third type of investment company is called the face amount certificate company. It's pretty much what it sounds like. You buy it either through installments or one lump sum, and there's a targeted date where it's going to pay out this higher face amount certificate. So those are all investment companies. They need to be registered. They need to register their prospectus, and part of this becomes a summary prospectus, and part of it becomes the statement of additional information. I don't know how far they're going to go in there, but you know, the book is probably a better place to get those really fine details. There's a lot of restrictions on investment companies. The open-end funds especially are not doing the high-risk trading strategies like selling short or trading on margin. If they want to borrow some money, they have to have a 3-to-1 asset-to-debt coverage. They might borrow money to handle redemptions, people who want to turn their shares into cash. That's fine, but a mutual fund can only borrow so much money. All right, so the Act of 33 is about registering securities. That's it. The Act of 34 covers a lot of things. It creates the SEC. It has the anti-fraud provisions. And they might even go so far as to say that exchanges and SROs have to register with the federal government. And it even gave the Federal Reserve Board the power to regulate margin. Margin's a topic that could show up a little bit here and there on the 6, probably not a big part of it in any case. So you've got the Federal Securities Acts, and then you've got some FINRA rules that we want to cover in this session. So FINRA is a self-regulatory organization. The broker-dealer firms belong to FINRA, and then those broker-dealer firms, after they register the firm, they also have to register the principals and the agents, which explains why you're listening to this today. You're going to become a Series 6 agent or registered rep. FINRA doesn't feel that you have the natural birthright to sell securities. They feel it's a privilege you have to earn. And if you ever file a false or misleading document with FINRA, they're going to give you a chance to explain why you did something that crazy, and then they're going to kick you out. So, you know, on your U4, for example, this is a big topic. If you look at my blog for the Series 7, pasthe7.blogspot.com, you'll see that the hottest topic is felonies and FINRA registration. You know, a lot of these guys, well, I didn't think they'd find out, so I didn't tell them on the U4 that 3 years ago I was busted for, you know. Well, FINRA is looking for full disclosure from you, and they're looking to see, in the past 10 years, have you been convicted of any felony or any misdemeanor that relates to the securities business, like theft, whether it's shoplifting, or even, I know a guy who barely got in because he jumped out of a cab without paying, theft of services, fraud, embezzlement, extortion, perjury. So anything that has to do with dishonesty or money, even if it was just a misdemeanor, they could certainly keep you out. And it's always worse to try to conceal this by filing a U4 that left out this information than just telling them what happened and explaining yourself. You know, so every time I've seen somebody mislead FINRA on the U4, that person has ended up being barred. Game over, find a new career. So don't file a false or misleading application, obviously. And some of these broker-dealers, maybe they are sloppy, maybe they just like to cut corners, but they'll actually allow people like you to go around selling without actually getting registered, which is a huge problem. the failure to register personnel properly, you know, that's going to get that firm fined and suspended or maybe even barred permanently. So some of you, up to now, maybe you've just been assistants, but you notice that you're taking more and more phone calls for people who need help placing trades, or just they need more explanation about mutual funds, whatever it would be, or you want to get paid to help people with their investments. Now you're here because you have to be licensed. You know, I'm sure there are a lot of brokers who use unlicensed, unregistered assistants and just hope nobody ever finds out, but FINRA has a way of finding out. So definitely have to register all your reps. And the two basic types of registration are either the general securities rep, which is a Series 7, and then you can sell just about anything you can imagine, or a limited representative investment company and variable contracts products. That's your full title for a Series 6. Everything you sell comes in a package set. You know, investors aren't buying individual shares of stocks or bonds. They're buying this package set, usually either a variable annuity or a mutual fund, and that's really all that you can sell. So the way I think of it is, do you want to sell the complete dinner package? That's the Series 6 license. You want to be able to sell securities a la carte. This guy wants 1,000 muni bonds. This guy, you know, wants to trade options. There you would need a Series 7. What if you're not going to be selling for a while? This is where a lot of corners have been cut. If you leave the business for more than 2 years, you're going to have to requalify by exam. So some agents who are going to take a sabbatical, they'll get some shady broker dealer to park the license and pretend that they're active when they're really not. That's a major FINRA violation. I know it happens. You know, I know a lot of bad things happen, but if you get caught, FINRA will come after that firm big time. You know, they say, well, you list him as one of your agents, but we don't see that he's done any business. Are you just trying to skirt the requirement for him or her to take the test? That's a bad idea, especially if you might get caught. All right, so if you're out of the business, I don't think the test would split hairs. I always forget, is it 2 years or more than 2 years? But right around 2 years, if you've been out of the business, you're probably going to have to requalify by exam. Unfortunately, there's also a rule that precludes people like me from going in to take the Series 6 all the time, because you have to be sponsored, not just sponsored, that's a bad word. People think that you're being sponsored to go take a test. No, you're being hired by a broker-dealer. And you're going to go take the Series 6 or the Series 7. If the firm, let's say they had a 1,000 reps who need help with the Series 7, and they want me just to go in there and take the test and use my near photographic memory to tell everybody what's on the test. Now, if a member applies for somebody just so he can go out there and take the exam, they're going to come after that firm pretty hard. So a lot of people think that the folks who work for the big companies are going in every week to take the exam. They might have even told you that. It's a total lie. You can only take the 6 or the 7 if you're being hired by a broker-dealer. And obviously you can't go around jumping from one firm to the next just so you can keep taking that exam. So if a firm tried to hire somebody, you know, maybe not even a test prep guy, but just, you know, the smartest rep that they had, let's just, you know, that guy can't sell, but let's just, you know, act like we keep hiring him and have him go take the Series 6 so he can come back and teach the class. You can't be doing that. I mentioned assistant reps. You know, if they're actually doing order processing, they're going to have to also qualify. A lot of the people taking the 6 are really just assistant reps, but if you want to get paid to help people with securities transactions, you got to get registered. Obviously, if you're just doing clerical or what they might call ministerial work, you're just the receptionist or doing what a temp worker might do, you don't have to get registered. It's the people who are actively dealing with a client's securities investments and trying to get compensated for selling mutual funds, etc. The qualification exams, which for you would be the Series 6, are highly confidential. So if you had a photographic memory, you took your Series 6, and then you posted 100 questions that you could somehow recall from memory, you'd be in huge trouble, and I'm pretty sure FINRA would find out. They would just kick you out permanently. For example, there's a guy who went to the testing center in Chicago a couple years ago to take his 7. He said he needed a bathroom break, but they watched him on camera go out to his car and get his Series 7 book. They caught him. FINRA kicked him out. He'll never work in the business again. I mentioned the U4. That's how you associate with a broker-dealer. This is where everything needs to come out. Do you have any felonies? Not just convictions, but charges. Any misdemeanors ever? So I mentioned 10 years. This is tricky. They use the stuff that happened in the last 10 years against you, but they ask you on U4, have you ever been charged with a felony? Have you ever been convicted with a felony? You better tell them the whole truth. You also have to include your name and address and any aliases you've ever used, you know, different forms of your name, Calvin Brodus, Snoop Doggy Dog, that kind of thing, your 5-year residency, your 10-year employment history. And if they find out you're fudging on any of that, you're going to get in huge trouble when they find out. Also, any felony or any what they call securities-related misdemeanor, which means perjury, forgery, any kind of theft, that kind of stuff, major red flags. So you have to disclose this on U4 if it ever happened. Usually they only come back at you if it happened in the previous 10 years. But they're going to make you tell your side of the story. 15 years ago, I was convicted of this felony. You're going to have to do some explaining. You know, you may get in, but if you leave it off your U4 and then they find out, then you're done. When you leave the firm, they file a U5, and they have to indicate why you're leaving. You know, was he permitted to resign because something bad happened? Did we fire him for cause? You know, that's going to be haunting you. You may never get another job if that happened. Or is it just, well, he got a better job, or he left? You know, this U4 and U5 information goes into FINRA's broker check. You might want to check that out yourself. Go to finra.org, type in somebody you know who's in the business. They'll tell you what licenses he or she has and if they've ever had any reported events. You know, they had to pay out an arbitration award or they were fired for cause. That's going to be in that broker check for a while. Broker check links to what they call the Central Registration Depository, the CRD. So all these U4s and U5s are in that CRD system, and then they open it up through broker check to the public. So if you ever get in trouble once, it's going to be a real downhill battle. I guess an uphill battle for you. The firms have principals, and in your case, they're going to have at least the Series 6 and the 26, and they have to supervise the salespeople, and they have to deal with the compliance of advertising and sales literature and so on and so on. And those guys often end up getting in trouble and suspended as well, you know. But those are called associated persons, whether you're a principal or you're an agent. FINRA defines a principal as a person associated with a member, that's the firm, member means member firm, who are actively engaged in the management of the member's investment banking or securities business, including supervision, solicitation, conduct of business, or the training of persons associated with a member for any of these functions. So investment banking is raising money on the primary market. Remember the Act of 33 from a few minutes ago. Or they're supervising you guys who are going out there to sell variable annuities and mutual funds, or they're training you guys. They're a principal. They're going to have to get registered, obviously. There's also some continuing education. And a lot of you guys have a ton of this because you're also insurance agents. I know, like in Illinois, every 2 years you got to get 30 hours of CE. Surprisingly, the requirements for the securities licenses are pretty light compared to insurance, but you do have a few. Every year you have to do something called the firm element. It's an annual training program that your firm puts you through. And there's also something called the regulatory element. You'll have to complete that within 120 days after your second year anniversary from getting registered. So you got registered, 2 years later, you'll have 120 days from that to complete the regulatory element, and then you'll do it every 3 years. If you don't complete it, your registration becomes inactive. You know, so you do have to do some basic CE. The firm also has to do an annual compliance review outside of the continuing ed requirements. You know, they're often going to have this as a live meeting. They can also do a webcast. As long, what FINRA wants to know is, can the people who are watching this webcast, can they get their questions answered in a timely manner? If so, then you can do that as opposed to having everybody meet in Milwaukee or San Diego or whatever it would be. If they ever asked you, how does FINRA determine the fees that the firms have to pay? It's based on the number of registered reps and the number of branch offices. So the more reps and the more branch offices you have, the more fees you have to pay. Can a firm use the FINRA name? Yeah, just don't use it in a way that falsely implies that FINRA has somehow given you the thumbs up. In other words, if you put up a business card that said a FINRA-approved brokerage firm, that's a big problem. You know, everybody's registered with FINRA. It sounds like you are trying to tell people you've got some special distinction. No, you can't do that. What else? In other words, if you put your name on the business card really small and then FINRA registered rep really big, they would say that's misleading too. So yeah, you can use the FINRA name, but it should just be a statement of fact. We're a member of FINRA. We're a member of SIPC. You've probably seen that at a lot of broker dealers. All right, so it's not a credential when you get registered. There are special rules about selling variable contracts. And real quickly, these are securities, like a variable annuity or even variable life. A broker-dealer can only sell these through a network of other registered broker-dealers. And they have to be prompt in terms of when they receive payment from the client. It has to be forwarded promptly and all that good stuff. Also, the companies that sponsor these mutual funds, or actually we're talking specifically about the variable contracts, the more you teach this stuff, the harder it is to separate a variable annuity from a mutual fund. But we are specifically talking about variable contracts. They can't go around trying to bribe all the registered reps in America to sell this particular investment product over all the others. So the test may bring up the situation, can this registered rep attend an annual training conference put on by the sponsor of a variable annuity product? Yeah, as long as it's not something that's done as a reward for meeting a sales target. If it's purely informational, that's fine. But they can only reimburse that rep for his expenses. You know, it can't be, hey, if you sell enough of these variable annuities, then you'll get to go to the so-called education seminar in Maui in January. No, it has to be a legitimate training seminar, and it can't be based on any type of a sales target. Similar rules for what they call investment company securities. That's kind of misleading because a variable annuity is, but when they say investment company securities, they're probably talking mostly about mutual funds. Well, you can't have excessive charges. There's a maximum sales charge of 8.5%, but to charge that much, you have to offer these things here. So FINRA certainly will set a cap on the maximum sales charge. Also, there's an anti-reciprocal rule. What is that? Well, the sponsor of a mutual fund, like American Funds Distributors, they can't go around trying to have other broker-dealers put their funds at the top of the list. They can't say, well, you know, we have to implement our trades through some broker-dealer. If you guys sell this much of our mutual fund products, will exclusively trade through you. Now, one hand washes the other, can't do it. Broker dealers should be recommending mutual funds only because they're suitable, not because the sponsor of the fund is going to reward that firm. So, anti-reciprocal rule. One hand wash. A lot of firms have been fined for this. FINRA calls it a shelf space program. You know, that's okay for grocery stores. You do have to pay shelf space just to get your cereal or your salsa on the shelf, but not in the world of mutual funds. Those things should only be recommended based on suitability, not on the fact that, well, hey guys, let's just sell these funds because the sponsor is going to take care of us the best. Can't do that, especially if you might get caught. All right, so know the basic federal acts. I think those are worth, you know, a handful of questions on the test. Keep the Act of 33 separate from the Act of 34. They may ask you a little bit about the Investment Company Act of 1940, possibly the Advisors Act of 1940, maybe. But at least know what an investment advisor is, because a lot of registered reps want to go out there and set up their own financial planning business without telling their firm and without getting registered. That's a real bad idea. That's why it might show up on the 6. And understand basic terms for FINRA registration. A member is the firm. They have principals who supervise the agents. You need to know that. You need to know what a U4 is. That's how you associate with a broker-dealer. A U5 is how you terminate. And if there's any negative information, the broker-dealer has to indicate that in the U5. And you're not going to be able to get another job with anybody until the U5 process is over. And of course, if there's negative information, you may never get a job again. But definitely know the basics. I think that's all we want to do here. We'll cover taxation in a separate lesson, and taxation is a huge part of the Series 6.